So here, it's like one big story.
It's late September on Blackfoot territory, and I'm about to hop on a bus to explore Writing on Stone Provincial Park. Or as the Blackfoot call it, Asinapi.
It's just a short drive. That's the archaeological preserve. That's what Napi quacks call it. The white people call it the archaeological preserve. But that's Asinapi. That's where the pictures are. The majority of petroglyphs and pictographs are along the sandstone cliff face.
Blair Minifingers is one of the interpreters at this park. The National Historic Site sits on the Milk River in southern Alberta, about 150 kilometers east of the Rocky Mountains. For the Blackfoot, it is a sacred place, a living cultural historical site. And Blair shares some of its ancient stories.
Whenever we retell a story, when we reshare the knowledge, it reconnects us with the land that sustains us in every way possible. So that's what we're going to do today, to reconnect with the land.
Blair is full of stories, and you'll hear some of them through the show. But first, he cautions us about some of the land's inhabitants.
The snakes are really active now. There's bull snakes and rattlesnakes, gardener snakes. But we're taught as Blackfoot people not to fear them, but to respect them. So this is their home. They're kind of like the guardians of this place. They keep your actions in check. So when you come to sacred sites, our elders say you come here with a good heart, good intentions. Those snakes, they keep you accountable. So you can't be walking through the grass. You got to be really mindful of your actions and where you step and what you say and do here.
The bus bumps along a winding, dusty road until we see a spectacular sight. To our right, a great sandstone cliff. And to our left, a valley of hoodoos, towering pinnacles of rock.
Yeah, if you sleep down here, you might see some pretty crazy stuff.
Yeah. Might not see you again.
There's an energy in this place, a quiet presence. Blair says it's because sacred spirit beings live here. He points to a large clay mound at the top of the coulee, a spirit lodge. Some travelers say they see orbs coming from the lodge. They travel through the valley, to the lookout, and back again.
If you're down here alone, it always feels like you're being watched. So it's very sacred.
For thousands of years, the Blackfoot have traveled to this place to connect with the spirit world and then make their markings. And so we set out to see the petroglyphs and pictographs and hear their tales. We do it with care, but considering the company.
We want to sleep here and have a vision quest.
We're also about to have a lot of fun along the way.
I have a dream that I want to win that lottery.
Tanse, Anine, Buju, hello, and welcome. This is Unreserved. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. Blair Manyfingers is breaking a lot of trail on his walks through Asinapi. As one of just two Blackfoot interpreters working for Alberta Parks, he wants to make way for future Indigenous guides and storytellers.
People who work here after my time here, I want to make it a more enjoyable experience for them, a more meaningful experience.
Meanwhile, in Banff National Park, Jordan Eve takes us off the beaten path. His medicine walks are a nod to Indigenous knowledge and science that predates colonization.
A lot of these medicines a while ago, it was not taken seriously, but now a lot of doctors and people in the pharmaceutical industry are taking these things more seriously.
And in a town known for its dinosaurs, Lynn Fabric is using community art spaces and gatherings to show the Indigenous history of Drumheller to travelers.
then they start to ask more questions. And that's really what it's about, is having people ask questions and get the truths, because that's how reconciliation starts, is by knowing the truths and knowing about the history here.
Today, Unreserved is Unmapped. This is our third stop in our travel series, where we look at popular tourist destinations through an Indigenous lens. All aboard to Alberta. Alberta is known for its wild side. It's a popular tourist destination for outdoor adventures, providing easy access to diverse landscapes. If you land in Calgary, like we did, you can be in Canada's oldest national park within an hour and a half of the airport. You can hike along pristine glacial waters and explore the layers of forest from aspen to pine. Head east instead, and it's the dusty hills and valleys of the Badlands, where you can eye up great hoodoos and search for dinosaur bones.
So guys,
that's what brought us to Drumheller to meet up with Don Johnston.
So right where we are right now, it's about 60 to 80 million years ago. We didn't have the climate we have today. We were tropical. And we were right beside an inland sea called the Bearspaw Sea. So this was an ideal place for the dinosaurs to gather in this area. That's why we had so many.
Don says new dinosaur discoveries are being made all the time here. Some are huge, like the Borealopelta ankylosaur, found in Fort McMurray.
The most intact dinosaur ever found in Alberta.
As far as we know, that's the world's best preserved armored dinosaur. And then there's instances like a few years ago when a lady found a prehistoric fish in her backyard.
And they figured that a meteorite hit near Mexico wiped out, it blocked the sun and wiped out the dinosaur. And that boundary around that explosion, it's called KT boundary. And they figured that we were on that KT boundary because they're finding micro diamond chips in the valley. And they figured the only place I could have come from was that meteorite. So there's a lot of things happening in the valley.
Don is well aware of the importance of dinosaurs and dinosaur lovers to tourism here. The Royal Tyrrell Museum of Paleontology has one of the world's largest displays of dinosaurs and brings in hundreds of thousands of people every year, 500,000 last year. By the way, that's also where you'll find that big Borealopelta ankylosaur on display. Alberta is home to the largest deposits of dinosaur bones on the planet. But Don and his wife Val wanted to share more about the valley. And so with Don's deep knowledge of the town's mining history,
over 140 coal mines in the valley,
and Val's research into her own Indigenous ancestry, the two started the Wild West Badlands Tours. Their promise? To help visitors travel the road less traveled, where people stop to smell, well, not the roses, but the sage. I feel sacred already.
This is a silver sage, so it's very common throughout the Badlands. It's a drier, more of a sage brush.
That's Don and Val's friend Lynn Fabric at the top of a very windy hill, looking over Horse Thief Canyon. Lynn likes to point out the silver sage and the buffalo sage, two easy-to-find medicines in the valley.
Sage is essential medicine in the Indigenous culture, along with cedar, sweetgrass, and tobacco, of course.
Yeah. It's quite hardy. It's quite a bit more hardy than what you would find.
It's very hardy because of our climate. Yeah. Like being that we're in the desert, we have extreme winters, we have extreme summers, so we go from really cold to really hot, and it has to be worthy of those temperatures.
Lynn is Cree Métis with family ties to Ermineskin Cree Nation, one of the four nations of Musqueaches in central Alberta. But she has lived here on Blackfoot territory for about 40 years. Lynn wants to see more Indigenous perspectives brought to tourism in the town, which is why she often joins Don and Val to share what she's learned from elders in the area.
These coulees, the coulees are the narrow valleys. A lot of them will have buffalo jumps. So whether they could drive them off the buffalo jump or chase them up the valley into a narrow section where they can't get out. And that would be a great means of hunting for the Indigenous people here. Buffalo,
roamed freely all the plains up here. So this was predominantly known as buffalo land.
The buffalo is our relative, and many of their bones remain at the bottom of this valley. The indigenous people here knew about some very, very big bones here, too. Lynn says some imagine them to be giant buffalo.
So what some may think of as dinosaur bones, we feel that they are our ancestors.
Lots of tourists come through this area, learn about the dinosaurs, learn about the buffalo, and so on. How often do they get to learn about the indigenous presence here?
I wish it were more. I am working on that through various ceremonies. For example, on September 30th, I have a ceremony at our downtown plaza for Truth and Reconciliation. And I've put up some murals around, some different art pieces, also inviting Indigenous artists to come and do Meet the Artist Night, talk about their history. And metal rail teepee put up down at our powwow site, which is behind the big dinosaur.
That big dinosaur Lynn's talking about is the world's largest, a 25-meter visitor center where you can climb up the 106 stairs through the belly of the beast to look out over this incredible valley. And in that valley is a historic gathering place for the Blackfoot and travelers from surrounding nations.
They would be leaving their weapons up here, and they would go down. Everyone would meet, and it would be like a United Nations of sorts, a truce. And they would sit around, and they would feast, and they would barter, and they would share. Once they were done, they would go back to the hills, pick up their weapons, and proceed to fight again. But when they were at the valley bottom by the river, and that's where we're putting that teepee, is to commemorate that as a neutral UN of sorts, of a gathering place that was very important to all the outlying nations. It's how you updated and shared information and bartered, maybe, you know, just to barter items that you may have come across and someone else was looking for. So it's got a huge indigenous history here. We want everyone to understand that, yes, we are dinosaur capital, but we have so much more than just dinosaurs. We do have the indigenous culture and the mining and the railroad and the farming, and it's such an amazing, very historical land.
Why do you think it's important to not just, you know, recognize the indigenous history here, but mark it and continue to educate people about that?
Initially, our visitors, when they come into the valley, they're dinosaur mined. So with having some visible structures or art pieces or ceremonies that they can take part in or see, then they start to ask more questions. And that's really what it's about, is having people ask questions and get the truths, because that's how reconciliation starts, is by knowing the truths and knowing about the history here. So having the teepee, having the murals, the gathering space, all of that, people start to ask more questions. So
absolutely. Yeah. And you had mentioned dinosaurs earlier, and that we can sort of consider them as indigenous people, our ancestors. Could you speak more to that? What is the understanding of dinosaurs in Cree culture here, or Blackfoot culture?
So it's believed, and we depicted in one of our murals, that the first discovery of dinosaur bones, I use air quotes when I say that, because the indigenous people, when they were along the river and along the valley bottom, came across these massive bones. And they did feel that they were giant bison, but they also knew that there was other ancient ancestors. So they knew to leave them alone. Don't dig them up, pray to them, respect them and honor them. So you leave them alone, then they leave you alone, kind of thing. It's like just living with the natural, the flow of, we found something very special and we're to respect that. So because they were left alone out of respect, it took many, many, many hundreds of years for them to be discovered and dug up.
Lynn Fabric is Cree Métis and lives in Drumheller in Treaty 7 territory. You're listening to Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, U.S. Public Radio, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. Today, Alberta Unmapped. We take a road trip through one of Canada's most popular tourism corridors, from the foothills of the Rocky Mountains to the Badlands. We're on Treaty 7 territory, home of the Blackfoot Confederacy. Still ahead, we head to Banff National Park to hike along pristine waters with some incredible mountain views. But we'll also be keeping our eyes on the ground, on the lookout for medicines.
So I'll talk a bit about the spruce trees, as well as the lodgepole pine. The spruce tree here, it's kind of like a grocery store, a pharmacy, and a hardware store all in one. And so what we can eat from the tree is in the springtime, when the new needles are growing, they're a lot softer than these older ones, and they're a much lighter color, and you can actually eat them right off of the tree. And you can also eat the inner bark, so the last layer before you get down to the wood. It's a good source of fiber and carbohydrate. But if we dig up the roots of this tree and scrape the bark off, the inside of the root is like an elastic when it's fresh, and it shrinks when it dries. And that's traditionally what we used to sew birch bark onto canoe frames. Now, the problem with that is where you've gone through with the needle and the root, you're going to have holes. And I used to be a boat captain, so I know firsthand that holes in a boat are not good. So we'd find a spruce tree with a nice big wound on it with a lot of sap that's come to the surface. And we could harvest that sap and boil it and mix in ashes from a fire and rabbit poop, which is really fibrous, and that then makes a waterproof glue that we would seal the canoes with. The sap was also chewed as a gum for medicine. It doesn't taste very good. It's what turpentine is made out of, but it was chewed for sore throats.
Jordan Eade is about to take us on a medicine walk in the Canadian Rockies. But first, we have more to see in the valley. Don and Lynn took us off the beaten path in Drumheller, but we're hungry for more stories from the Badlands, so we head further south to Asenapi, a national historic site in southern Alberta. It's an archaeological preserve and a very sacred place to the Blackfoot. For thousands of years, the Blackfoot have visited this place to seek guidance.
Those hills over here, they're known as the Sweetgrass Hills. They're a part of this park. So the sacredness of this part and all the meanings and the stories of this park, it transcends the boundaries of this park and of Canada, because those hills are located in Montana across the Medicine Line.
Our guide today is Blair Manyfingers.
On a map, they're known as the Sweetgrass Hills, but to the Blackfoot, they're known as Gatoiks, or the Sweet Pine Hills, not the Sweetgrass Hills, but the Sweet Pine Hills. So there's alpine fir that grows there. It's a sweet-smelling pine tree that grows at higher elevations in the alpine. And it's a sacred medicine for the Blackfoot. It's very special for that sweet pine to grow in the middle of the prairies. So for that, we call them the Sweet Pine Hills. You could also call them the Blood Clot Hills. And Blood Clot, Katoisa, he was like a culture hero to the Blackfoots. He was the Superman of our stories, our legends. And there's truth in those stories.
If you want to hear more about the Blackfoot Superman, go pay a visit to Blair, because right now, we're about to feast our eyes on some rock art. There are more than 200 pictographs and petroglyphs in this valley, and they all remind us of our connection to the land.
Take it all in. Use all your senses. If you're archaeologists, they like using their sense of taste. They lick rocks. Did you know that? So if they see a rock and they're not sure if it's a fossil or a rock, they'll lick it. a fossil is porous, so it's a bone, it will stick to their tongue, but if it's a rock, it will just, it's not sticky. So archaeologists will use all their senses.
Are you just trying to get us to lick rocks? After our rock-licking instructions, we wind our way up the side of the cliff. Some of the markings are so clear, even though they're thousands of years old. Like this one that explains how the Blackfoot discovered the buffalo jump.
So when you look over here, this panel right here, you ought to come over here to see it. There's a buffalo falling off right here. So that panel, it's pretty cool. It's oval shaped. It kind of looks like a projectile point, like a spear point. And there's a buffalo fallen head down, like it's off going off a cliff. Oh, yeah. Do you see it?
The Blackfoot would hunt buffalo this way in the fall. They'd work together to stockpile meat for the long, cold winter. And these markings explain it all.
So the kill site's right down here. The gathering basin, that edge might be the cliff. They fall down to the kill site. And over here, it could be the processing site. So they were there for days, working 24 hours around the clock. Gutting, skinning, deboning, and processing all that buffalo into dry meat, to gai. So that was the most profitable way of hunting in all of human evolution. No other culture in the entire world came up a way of hunting that's better than the buffalo jump, the piskan. This is the cream of creation, and the Blackfoot people perfected it.
As one of just two Blackfoot interpreters in all of Alberta parks, Blair says his work comes with great responsibility to share Blackfoot stories in a good way. And it just might be his destiny.
I'll introduce myself in Blackfoot, Nitsipawasan, Oki Nastu Anago Isomachka. So I said, hello, my name is Isso Machka, driving along the beach. I'm from Gana First Nation, which is part of the Blackfoot Confederacy. And I'm from the Fish Eaters Clan, the Mamiyoks. My name is Isso Machka, driving along the beach. I grew up kind of wondering about it, like, where does it come from? Well, in Blackfoot territory, there's no oceanfront property. And there's not really any beaches or anything like that. So I asked my mom, and she said, my uncle went to California when I was a baby. And when he came back from that trip to California, my mom asked him to name me. And we usually are, when somebody's asked to name a baby, they smudge and they pray about it. And that's what he did. He prayed about it. And he remembered driving along the beach in California, those cliffs and the ocean. And I always wondered about it. When I worked here, I learned that this area 85 million years ago was covered by the interior seaway. And right along that interior seaway, this is where the beach was located. And it left behind different types of sediment, including sand. And over millions and millions of years, and through the dinosaurs and the extinction of the dinosaurs, and all those glacial ice ages, that sand was compacted from those glaciers into sandstone, concreted sand. And as those glaciers melted and eroded away the river valley, it exposed this ancient sandstone, all these sandstone formations. So it's an ancient beach And I had to get my class 4 driver's license to drive those tour buses. So when I'm driving along back into the archaeological preserve, I'm driving along an ancient beach. So that name, it brought me to where I needed to go in life.
Wow, that's an amazing story. You almost feel like you were destined to be here.
Yeah, it's kind of feels like that. That's what I was told, where you need to go in life, those spirits, our ancestors, they'll point you and guide you to where you need to go.
So you took us on a 2-hour tour. That was the most walking I've done in a long time, by the way. what did you share with us today on the tour?
I shared the Blackfoot connection with the land, which is depicted here on the sandstone. So Peter Weasel Moccasin Manipoka, he says that Asanapi is like one big winter count. Our entire way of life is depicted on the sandstone. A winter count is a record of our history drawn in a spiral with pictographs on a buffalo hide, and every pictograph represents an event in our history. And different people would keep these records on buffalo hide. So when he says this place is like one big winter count of who we are as Blackfoot people, it's all these symbols of petroglyphs that are carved and sized onto sandstone, and pictographs that are painted onto the sandstone. All those symbols represent our entire way of life, we say. And it's a Bata beast, the real people's way of life, the true way of life. Our buffalo hunting culture, our warrior culture, our spirituality, let's say Atsamoikon, our prayers, the reminders of how to pray. There's a lot of stories and knowledge embedded into the land here. So it's very sacred. We'll never forget who we are as Blackfoot people as long as we continue the tradition of leaving our marks here.
Why is it important to share these kinds of stories with people?
A lot of our people, because of colonization, have grown up not knowing who they are as Indigenous people or as Blackfoot people. In residential school, there was a huge loss of identity. Our stories, our songs, our ceremonies, our languages were fractured. And we could see the results of that in the opioid epidemic, and the people on the streets struggling through addiction. All our families, our relatives are going through that. And a big part of it is a loss of identity, a loss of who we are as Indigenous people. So these markings here, these symbols, they're serving a purpose. When Indigenous people come here and Blackfoot people come here, they reconnect with their way of life. They hear those stories, that knowledge that's embedded within those symbols. And they feel this metaphysical connection, not to the land or on the land, but with the land. And that's something very profound. It empowers them to set them on a good path in life. Even for non-Indigenous people, that relationship between Indigenous and non-Indigenous people, it needs to be healed. There's been a lot of conflict that's steeped in misunderstandings and the inability to really respect each other's cultures and ways of life. So when non-Indigenous people come here on tours, they learn about who we are as Blackfoot people. And they're not only just talking about reconciliation or reading about it, they're put in reconciliation into action. They're actively involved in it. They're going out onto the land.
listening to our stories. So that's reconciliation in action. It's healing that relationship between us.
And why do you want to be part of it? Why is it important for Blair to teach people and learn and unlearn and help them with our own shared story?
We're all on our own individual healing journeys, but it's so connected with everybody else. Gregory Schofield, he says, we all share similar stories of healing. We've all have this collective trauma that has been placed upon Indigenous people. But how we heal is in our own unique ways. Learning your culture, going back to your elders, your stories. And a lot of us are students and riders. You say we're all riding our way out of trauma. We're all riding our way back into our languages, back into our culture, our stories, our songs, and back into a better sense of who we are as Indigenous people. So when we come here to Riding on Stone, that's what we're doing. We're a part of that journey. So for myself, my journey has been very profound. I was up to no good long time ago, and when I was a plumber. And I was caught in addiction, drinking. And I was up to no good, causing a lot of trouble within myself and my loved ones. And my brother invited me into a sweat lodge. And I've never been in a sweat lodge before. Like, it was a homecoming almost. And after that, I didn't realize it, but I slowly started making better decisions in my life. It was because of our ceremonies and our culture that set me on that right path in life. So I quit drinking. I decided to go back to school. I went to Red Crow Community College in Standoff, Alberta, on the Kainai Reserve, or the Blood Tribe. And I really learned a lot of who I was as a Blackfoot person. Elders would visit our classes. We'd smudge before classes. And I learned so much. I was set on that good path in life because of that reconnection of decolonizing who I am, relearning and unlearning. And it led me to receive a Bachelor of Arts in Indigenous Studies from the University of Lethbridge, and with a minor in English, and then to these pretty cool positions of being an interpreter at a UNESCO World Heritage Site, but first and foremost a Blackfoot sacred site. And it led me to a master's program. So now I'm taking a Master's of Arts program at the University of Lethbridge, and my thesis is going to focus on the heritage management of Asinate via Blackfoot sacred sites. So how do we bring our way of life that adheres to our protocols? How do we represent our stories, our songs, our ceremonies, our culture, our way of life in an appropriate way that gives us self-determination in such a beautiful place here? So,
how do you know what to share and what not to share on these tours with people?
It's a fine line of respect. We say atsamappi, a sense of the sacredness. So we can't go into the details of ceremony. What I share is general knowledge of the Blackfoot people. There was a time when all Blackfoot, all Indigenous people, we knew our stories, our songs, our ceremonies, our language, and we have to bring that back. So what I share is general knowledge, but because it's in such a sacred site, and because some of these stories, they walk the line of the general knowledge and the sacred knowledge, you have to be very mindful of not going into too many details about it. And then there's certain songs that are meant for ceremony, and we don't share those with anyone outside a ceremony. So you only can sing and songs in ceremony, but if you're on a public tour, you can't sing those songs, or they just stay in ceremony.
What are some of the challenges that you face as an Indigenous interpreter at a place like this? I understand you're only one of two?
Yeah, so there's only two Blackfoot interpreters here. And throughout Alberta parks, I'm certain there is only two Indigenous interpreters. So there's interpretation here at Riding on Stone, at Dinosaur Provincial Park, at Kananaskis near Banff, and a few other parks have small interpretation programs. So some of the challenges are like our spiritual safety in a sacred site. And that kind of is something private, that's sacred, that has to occur between us and our elders. So we have to bring our elders here to keep us safe, which is, they're making an effort, but there needs to be a little more effort from them. Some tours are conducted by non-Indigenous interpreters, so that's when you go into cultural misappropriation. So we need more Blackfoot people to work here, and not only in seasonal positions, but full-time positions where we have some decision-making abilities. There has to be co-management with our leaders in Alberta Parks. So there's a lot of work that needs to be done. And there's all these different actors in it. There's the locals that live around here, Alberta Parks, archaeologists, and Blackfoot people. There's all these different stakeholders that need to work together in order for this place to be represented in an authentic, real way, respecting protocols and that sacredness.
What is your hope for Riding on Stone National Park?
I hope that it's one day that our people co-management, that there's an advisory board of elders that meets in an apolitical way, of more of relationship building with each other, and that there's a line, like some elders will say, well, this place, it was never meant to bring busloads of people on tours. There's some things that we have to keep to ourselves. So when you bring busloads of people constantly to a sacred site that's almost exploiting it, there has to be more thought into how we structure these tours, like how we deliver them and what we share. So me, I don't know, I might get into trouble by some of my elders, but I was told I'm doing good just to keep moving forward with it. So.
And it is your destiny after all.
I hope so. Yeah, it really feels like I've come full circle here. So, and I want to give back, like Blackfoot people who work here after my time here, I want to make it a more enjoyable experience for them, a more meaningful experience.
Well, thank you so much, Blair, for your time and for the tour today.
Yeah, you're welcome.
I will say. Blair Manyfingers is Blackfoot from Kaurna First Nation. This is Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, U.S. Public Radio, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. Today, we're unmapped in Alberta. It's the third of our occasional travel series where we explore popular tourist destinations from the Indigenous perspective. We've been exploring the Badlands on Blackfoot territory with the Rockies in full view.
Now it's time to dust ourselves off and take in some fresh mountain air. Banff National Park is Canada's oldest national park. More than 4 million people visit each year. They come for the trails, the thermal pools, and the boutique hotels. But our guide, Jordan Eid, comes for the rose hips.
All right, so here we have the wild rose. Now, the flowers are out of season, but the rose hips themselves have ripened, but they're not ready yet.
Jordan is taking me and my producer, Kim, on one of his guided walks.
Oh, I guess I should wait for Kim. Don't leave a producer behind. They don't like that.
Yeah.
This trail is just outside the town of Banff in the Bow Valley and not far from Lake Minnewanka. We're surrounded by pristine waters and stunning mountain views. We make our way through this northern boreal forest, and Jordan tells us about traditional uses of plants for food and medicine, starting with those almost ripe enough rose hips.
So right now, they're pretty bland and flavorless. But pretty soon, when we get nights dropping below zero and we get frost on all the plants, then the rose hips start to sweeten. Kind of like a same as, leaving grapes on the vine into the fall for ice wine. And so that's when they're ready to harvest. And the rose hips would be dried and ground up into a powder. And it was one ingredient in a type of tea that was commonly drank in the winter. Now, you would never, ever want to pick a rose hip and eat it whole. The problem with that, if it hasn't been ground up, is the seeds. So if you eat the seeds, they'll go down to your stomach, they'll go through the digestive tract, they'll make it almost all the way out, but they've got little hairs on them that are kind of like Velcro, and they get stuck at the exit for a little while. And I can't remember what the Cree word is, but one of the things that we would call rose hips in Cree would translate into English as itchy bum berry.
I'm going to ask my mom about that.
And so the reason it was used in this winter tea is it's a really good source of vitamin C. And so there'd really be no other, fresh fruits available in the winter. And so that's why it would have been drank in the winter.
Jordan is Cree and Iroquois Métis. He's a guide at Mohican Trails, a tourism company started by his mom, Brenda. Brenda is a knowledge keeper and medicine woman from the Assiniboine Winnewaw Nation in the Jasper area. Together, they're making sure the Indigenous history here is told.
So the Indigenous presence here, this is actually quite a significant area, and it was a trading area. Traditionally. So the reason it was a trading area is the Bow Valley is an east-west valley, one of only a few east-west valleys in the Canadian Rockies. And east-west travel is through the mountains is easier than north-south because you remain in the same ecoregion. There's also a large, slow-moving river, and the best way to travel was by canoe. And so people from east of the Rockies, like the Cree, the Blackfoot or Niitsitapi, the Nakoda, and the Sutina, and then later on the Métis, would come into here to meet with people from the west side of the Rockies, like the Shuswap, Tanaha, and Kootenay. And so there would be a lot of trade. I mean, we had things that they didn't have access to in the interior of BC, and the same was true with people from the interior of BC. They had things that we didn't have access. And so some of the things that people from east of the Rockies had to trade would be things like the buffalo hides, as well as with our colder winters, we had better quality furs from beavers and other animals. And some of the things that they would have had in the interior of BC that we didn't have access to would be things like cedar, tobacco, as well as obsidian, which is a volcanic glass, which was the best material for making arrowheads, knives, and other stone tools.
Wow, that's fascinating.
Ooh. All right, so there's a lot of tree roots coming up in this next section, so just keep an eye out for tripping hazards.
Yeah. Tripping hazards indeed. You step so softly, I'm pretty sure you could sneak up on a bear. Not that you would want to, of course.
No. So as we stepped off the trail to walk around the fallen tree, we were walking on a bit of this moss that we have on the forest floor. And so this moss would be used in something called a moss bag, which would kind of be, you know, a backpack made out of animal hide. And the moss would be picked and dried, and you'd put it in the backpacks, and then women would put their babies in it. And so, as you felt, it's very, very soft when you were walking on it, so it's nice and comfortable for the babies. When it's dried, it can hold 20 times its weight in water, so it made a diaper, and it's antiseptic, so the babies wouldn't get diaper rash, and that's how women would carry their babies when they were out harvesting.
Huh. Very cool. Where did you learn this traditional knowledge?
So I learned a lot of it actually from my mom, with her being a knowledge keeper and medicine woman. And this has been passed down through the family for a very long time. And with me, my style when I'm out on the trail, I like to come from both the traditional indigenous perspective and the scientific and mix them together, because a lot of these medicines a while ago, it was not taken seriously, but now a lot of like doctors and people in the pharmaceutical industry are taking these things more seriously.
Mm-hmm. Why is it important for you to share this knowledge with other people?
I think it's important, you know, to try and reconnect people to the land. And I don't just mean like indigenous people, but everyone, because these medicines belong to everyone. And I think so many people have become so far removed from the land that I think it's important to reconnect.
We're not going up there, are we?
Good.
So I'll talk a bit about the spruce trees as well as the lodgepole pine. The spruce tree here is kind of like a grocery store, a pharmacy, and a hardware store all in one. And so what we can eat from the tree is in the springtime, when the new needles are growing, they're a lot softer than these older ones, and they're a much lighter color, and you can actually eat them right off of the tree. And you can also eat the inner bark, so the last layer before you get down to the wood. It's a good source of fiber and carbohydrate. But if we dig up the roots of this tree and scrape the bark off, the inside of the root is like an elastic when it's fresh, and it shrinks when it dries. And that's traditionally what we used to sew birch bark onto canoe frames. Now, the problem with that is where you've gone through with the needle and the root, you're going to have holes. And I used to be a boat captain, so I know firsthand that holes in a boat are not good. So we'd find a spruce tree with a nice big wound on it with a lot of sap that's come to the surface. And we could harvest that sap and boil it and mix in ashes from a fire and rabbit poop, which is really fibrous. And that then makes a waterproof glue that we would seal the canoes with. The sap was also chewed as a gum for medicine. Doesn't taste very good. It's what turpentine is made out of, but it was chewed for sore throats. We can also use the sap on small wounds. And so it does two things on a wound. One is it'll either reduce or prevent scarring. And that's important not just for vanity reasons, but when you have a scar, your blood vessels don't really flow through the scar tissue. So if you get a cut on that scar, and that's that cut gets infected, then there's really not much that your immune system can do about it. So that's why we don't want scars. And another thing it can it'll do on a small wound is it'll help speed up the healing process. Something you want to be a little bit careful with, you really need to make sure that the wound is clean, that there's nothing in it. Because normally, a wound healing on its own will heal from the bottom up. When you add the sap, it starts healing at the bottom and then the top. So if you haven't properly cleaned the wound out and there's anything in there, it can get trapped in the body, which can result in some pretty nasty infections. Now, one of the most important uses for this tree, particularly in the wintertime, I mentioned the rosehip being one ingredient in a type of tea. Another thing that we would use would be spruce and pine needles in the tea. And so the needles on their own, they don't taste that great, but when you add the rose, it becomes a lot sweeter. And so the pine and spruce needles themselves, 100 grams of the needles is about as much vitamin C as 4 or 5 oranges. So it's really, really important in the winter to prevent scurvy. And then another use of the sap is where my great-grandmother lived. It's pretty easy to get there now, but when she was younger, it was quite remote. And there'd only be a doctor coming out to her area from Edmonton once a year. to check on people. So throughout the rest of the year, it was her job to keep everybody healthy. So nowadays, things like colds, flus, pneumonia, not that big of a deal for most people. But back then, those things could be life-threatening. And if somebody came to her because they couldn't cough and clear out their lungs, what she would do is she would take the sap, heat it up just enough to melt it, put it on the person's chest, and then take a piece of tanned hide from the shoulder of a moose or a buffalo. And the hide on the shoulder of those two animals is very thick. And so she'd put that tanned hide over top, and the thickness was important because the next step would be to take rocks out of a fire that had been sitting in fire for several hours, put them on the hide, and the hide would protect the person from getting burned, but the heat would force the vapors of the sap into the person's chest and into their lungs. And she'd do that until the rocks had cooled, then she'd flip the person over, do the same on the back, and then once the rocks would cool, again on the chest, back and forth until the person could clear their lungs out again.
Like old school Vicks VapoRub.
Yeah, pretty much.
I remember my mom giving me some of this when I had a cold as a youngster. You're right, it tastes really horrible.
Yeah, it does taste like turpentine. Don't ask how I know what turpentine tastes like.
I'll skip that question. Good trails. What do you love about this job?
I just love meeting people from all over the world, all different cultures, finding, commonality, and just sharing my culture and the land that we're on with them.
Why do you think so non-Indigenous people are so interested in learning about, things like plants and medicines and Indigenous presence in places like this?
I mean, with the whole, truth and reconciliation that we're working on right now, I think people just kind of want to learn about my culture and various other Indigenous cultures and, try to bridge those gaps between the communities.
Yeah. And how do they generally react after or during the walk?
They generally tend to really enjoy it. I try to be fun out there, be as entertaining as possible, share stories, get some laughs. But I think a lot of times people leave with, a deeper appreciation for the area that we're in.
Why is it important for you to make sure that visitors, have a greater respect for this knowledge and for the land?
So that, everybody can kind of work together and try and, preserve these areas and even restore them to their natural state. I hope that they leave with, a connection to the land and a deeper understanding and with the message of, trying to preserve and restore. Maybe they take that message back home with those same goals with wherever it is that they're from.
Are we winding up here?
Yeah, we
seem to be back at the parking lot.
Back at the parking lot.
That didn't feel like an hour. Was it an hour?
It was an hour.
Felt like 20 minutes. Thank
You're
you,
welcome.
Jordan. That was wonderful.
Jordan Eade is Cree and Iroquois Métis and a guide for Mohican Trails. And that was a beautiful walk through Cascade Ponds in Banff National Park.
Yeah, now we're back here, safe and sound, same amount of people as we started with.
Yeah, that's good. Everybody's accounted for. We almost lost Kim a couple times, but...
That's all our time on Radio Indigenous. This episode was produced by Kim Casher, Elena Hutchins-Lyle, Rhiannon Johnson, and Bridget Stringer Holden. You can now listen to us streaming live on the CBC News app. Just go to the local tab and press play. You can also find and follow us wherever you get your podcasts. I'm your favorite cousin, Rosanna Deerchild, coming at you from Blackfoot Territory in Treaty 7, Alberta. Kinanaskamit Nawa, Agusay.